And that, very simply, is the transcendental method. An exclusively deductive argument would take an axiom such as that every cause must have an effect and reason in a straight line from such an axiom, drawing all manner of conclusions about God and man. A purely inductive argument would begin with any fact and seek in a straight line for a cause of such an effect, and thus perhaps conclude that this universe must have had a cause. Both of these methods have been used, as we shall see, for the defense of Christianity. Yet, neither of them could be thoroughly Christian unless they already presupposed God. Any method, as was pointed out above, that does not maintain that not a single fact can be known unless it be that God gives that fact meaning, is an anti-Christian method. What does this expression mean, to give a fact meaning? Well, to put it bluntly, it means to give any particular sensation a context in terms of which it's connected to other things. It's related to the problem of predication. But here he's talking about facts in the sense of sensing something in the world. In order for me to make sense of, okay, right now I'm sensing Mike Butler's shoe, right? But in order for that sensation to make sense, I had to understand that it was a shoe connected to a foot, or theoretically connected to a foot. I have to understand what shoes are for. I have to understand what the English word shoe means, and so forth. Van Til says, we don't just have brute sensations. They are interpreted, and therefore they are meaningful. Interpretation in one way or another, either by causal connections, logical connections, sometimes literary and imposed connections. Anyway, particulars are connected to other particulars, and therefore there's a pattern of meaning. Any method, as was pointed out above, that does not maintain that not a single fact can be known unless it be that God gives that fact meaning, is an anti-Christian method. On the other hand, if God is recognized as the only and the final explanation of any and every fact, neither the inductive nor the deductive method can any longer be used to the exclusion of the other. That this is the case can best be realized if we keep in mind that the God we contemplate is an absolute God. What does it mean, an absolute God? I ask questions and then I answer them, right? What? Okay, you tell me. What's an absolute God? What's absolute mean? Say what? I can't. Covenantal? Comprehensive, okay. Comprehensive meaning covering everything, so there's nothing missing. There's no flaw in God. Okay. Comprehensive, he's in control of all things, so he doesn't have to worry about any other factor coming in to what he does. He's unconditioned. He's unqualified. He doesn't answer to anything. He's not subject to any conditions except his own. Okay, so absolute means unqualified, without restriction. God is unrestrictedly God. Nothing keeps him from exercising his sovereign prerogative. There's no ignorance outside him that he has to worry about. There's no force outside him that he has to deal with. God is absolute. Van Til says, now the only argument for an absolute God that holds water is a transcendental argument. A deductive argument, as such, leads only from one spot in the universe to another spot in the universe. That's his metaphorical way of saying what Kant did, that deductive arguments for God are only dealing with the way our mind works in this phenomenal, with our phenomenal experience of the natural world. From one spot in the universe to another spot. It never leads to a spot outside the universe, is Van Til's point. So also an inductive argument, as such, can never lead beyond the universe. In either case, there is no more than an infinite regression. In both cases, it is possible for the smart little girl to ask, if God made the universe, who made God? And no answer is forthcoming. This answer is, for instance, a favorite reply of the atheist debater Clarence Darrow. That gives you some idea of how old this book is. He chooses as his contemporary example Clarence Darrow. That's okay. But if it be said to such opponents of Christianity that unless there were an absolute God, their own questions and doubts would have no meaning at all, there is no argument in return. Bingo. Again, you want to make sure you have that highlighted in your book. Unless there were an absolute God, their own questions and doubts would have no meaning at all. Vantil says, there lie the issues. So people may have what seem on the surface to be really strong considerations against God, arguments and challenges. But Van Til's apologetic doesn't say, give us enough time, we'll work out an answer to everything that comes down the pike. We can do that too. Van Til says, you couldn't even make sense of your argument if the God you were arguing against didn't exist. And I'm going to digress for a moment to illustrate this, because I want to make sure everybody appreciates this. It's not always easy in epistemology and metaphysics to get people up and running, but I find most people understand ethical considerations. So I'm going to use ethics for the sake of clarity of illustration. Let's say somebody comes to me and says, Dr. Bahnsen, how could you possibly believe in a God that allows all these wicked, evil things to happen in the world? Now, maybe I could come up with an answer for every single evil thing that happens in the world to satisfy the unbeliever. Probably not. But Van Til says, why even get started going down that line when the best thing to say is your very objection presupposes the thing you're objecting to? How is that? Let's analyze this. Think this through. A person comes to me and says, wicked, evil things happen in this world, so God couldn't exist. I say back to him, that argument presupposes that God exists. Because if you don't presuppose that God exists, you can't call anything evil and wicked. I know that seems strange because psychologically the thrust of the argument is anti-God, no doubt about it. But what we're going to be able to do if we reason transcendentally is to say, no matter what the direction of the argument is, as an argument, it presupposes God. And that's why no argument can ever disprove God, because as an argument, it assumes the thing that it's trying to disprove. Now, I told you all, you must jump in. Does anybody not understand this? I hope you consider it brilliant. I didn't do it myself, so I'm not asking for... But I mean, that reply, there is no way out of that. Now, there are psychological problems with evil. There's no doubt about it. And if I tell somebody God has a morally sufficient reason for what he does, but you can't call anything good or evil if you don't have God to begin with, that doesn't mean that you feel real easy about the evil that you see. They say, oh, okay, well now Bosnia is perfectly all right with me. You know? Or now mass murder is perfectly... No, it's not. I have lots of days about my own puny life, but also about big, massive things that are in the news when I say, I just don't understand why God does that. It's not an attempt, you know, to dethrone God. But I psychologically am not sanctified enough to put everything in the best context and in faith, trust God and so forth. So I understand that there will still be problems. But there can't be an intellectual problem with Christianity or the Christian worldview if someone is going to assume an absolute distinction between good and evil and then try to argue against God. Because God is the presupposition for an absolute distinction between good and evil. There are other kinds of distinctions between good and evil that you might draw without God, but there won't be absolute ones.
Has anybody ever come up with anything that seems to have any value as their explanation of good and evil without?
Never. Never. And I'm glad to report that to you. You may find it hard to believe. It seems like why unbelievers don't fall down dead before the argument, but they never come up with anything. What they'll say is, like secular philosophers would tell you, well, we draw the distinction between good and evil even though we don't believe in God. I say, oh, yeah, I agree that you draw that distinction. It's just on your worldview, the distinction doesn't have any meaning or has no objective truth to it. Because in the end, all you're saying is one person prefers this, another prefers that. Okay, so let's say I talk to a philosopher who says, no, wait a minute, I know that child molestation is wicked. I draw that distinction, and I don't believe in God at all. I say, oh, okay, so you subjectively draw the distinction. That doesn't mean that child molestation is wicked, does it? Because the person who molests the child doesn't think that it's wicked. So all you're telling me is that everybody makes choices. But what I want to know is how you can call it wicked if all you're saying is that person chose something I didn't choose. It's not wicked, it's just not your preference. That's not your cup of tea to molest children, but it is that of others. So yeah, people will say we can draw the distinction, but they can't ever make it an absolute distinction. That is objective outside of... Now what's our pattern from this morning? Reduce it to subjectivism and skepticism. Cammie? That's right.
Right.
Van Til would teach us, I think the Bible teaches us, that when people draw scientific conclusions, logical conclusions, ethical conclusions, that they're implicitly referring to God and His character, His mind. And so what happens is you get brilliant scientists who aren't Christians, but they're thinking... They have to think in terms of God, but then they do what? They call it nature. Right? Or you have brilliant philosophers who can do all these logical deductions, and they have the rules of logic. But then rather than referring them to the mind of God, they think that the rules of logic are somehow existent in themselves. For Plato, in a realm beyond this world, most philosophers today aren't that crude, but... In some sense, there are principles that are not in the material world, but they're not in God, but they're nevertheless separate. Okay, so what happens is you secularize God. You take God's holy character, which is personal, concrete. That's why we're angry about this mother who kills her children, because we're all made in the image of God and so forth. But then the secular world doesn't want to admit there's a God, so what do? They secularize that as a principle.
This is changing the creature from the creator.
Bingo. That's exactly right. You take what is the creator and you try to make the creature the measure of that now. You creaturalize, bring down to the level of the creature what is in fact a transcendent aspect of the creator.
And in turn, lift the creature to worship the creature.
Yeah. And so men worship their logic, their scientific methodology. Yeah, or nature, yeah, or ethical principles. There are people who worship love. Not because there's, well, I don't know, in California there might be a temple of love somewhere, I'm not sure. No, not that there's a temple to love, Eros or whatever, but people do, they give their lives for these things, right? It's their religion. It's that which is their ultimate concern and their final authority.
What about when they make appeal to natural laws? They say, well, this is unethical because of natural laws.
Okay, what they're appealing to is what? Nature. Now, let's just think about this. The natural law ethic is so ridiculous, so puerile in terms of intellectual respectability. When you look at nature, do you see any ethical principles? Does anybody? Ethical principles can't be seen in nature. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, if you want to say, no, you don't see ethics, you don't see ought out there in the world. But what is in the world, what you can describe, can be translated into an ethical principle by generalization. Well, that's a big logical leap from what is the case to what ought to be the case. Most of us, would approach ethics with the idea that the reason we're studying ethics is because the world ain't the way it's supposed to be. So if you now go to the world to find out what it is, and then you're going to exalt that into what it ought to be, why bother to do ethics at all? And then as a further step, and this is what you guys were getting at, when we do study the world and its generalizations, is it usually the case that animals respect private property? Are animals usually monogamous? So forth? I mean, if you think that our ethical code comes from natural law, you're being silly. On the other hand, if you believe that God has an objective principle of right or wrong, his own character, that is known apart from personal or individual instances of well, interpersonal relationships are dealing with property, then you're absolutely right. But if that's what it is, why call it natural law? Why don't you call that God's law? That's God's character that we see, and we think God himself is known through the natural order. So, but in all of these things, draw back and look at what's common to them all. The unbelieving world takes what is God's and tries to make it some aspect of creation, the created order, laws of logic in themselves, nature, what have you. Okay, back to Van Til. I'll reread this. But if it be said to such opponents of Christianity that unless there were an absolute God, their own questions and doubts would have no meaning at all, there is no argument in return. Van Til knows that there's a lot of kibitzing in return. A lot of people don't like that. But basically, there's no way to get around that. If argument presupposes God, then you can't argue against God successfully. There's no argument in return, because every time you try to argue, you're just insisting again, there's meaning, there's coherence, there's unity, there's intelligibility in the world. It is the firm conviction of every epistemologically self-conscious Christian. I love that expression. I'm waiting for the Christian bookstores to come out with the button. Are you an epistemologically self-conscious Christian? Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. Well, yeah, it'd have to be a big button to get those big words on there. But man, what does it mean, epistemologically self-conscious? We're not being arbitrary. We're not just following our emotions or feelings, but we're being reflective. We're thinking about ourselves. We're being self-conscious, and we're trying to be consistent in our theory of knowledge. Okay? It is the firm conviction of every epistemologically self-conscious Christian that no human being can utter a single syllable, whether in negation or in affirmation, unless it were for God's existence. So another way of putting it is, the only way you can argue with me is by talking to me, but you couldn't utter a syllable, you couldn't make sense out of language without a worldview, which is the Christian worldview. Therefore, if you talk at all, you're assuming the worldview that you're arguing against. Thus, the transcendental argument seeks to discover what sorts of foundations the house of human knowledge must have in order to be what it is. That's another one of those defining sentences here. The transcendental argument seeks to discover what sort of foundations the house of human knowledge must have in order to be what it is. We're not arguing about what the house of knowledge is. We're taking it for what it claims to be. Okay? So if I argue with somebody about induction, and I say, you know, you couldn't use induction unless you had a broader principle, namely the existence of God who orders all things. Somebody else might come along and say, yeah, well, prove to me that I should use induction. I say, well, I'm taking the house of knowledge as it is. If you don't want to use induction, I'll talk to you about other things, namely, like, you can't get away from it. But on the assumption that we're going to be inductive, Van Til says, then you can't escape Christianity. The transcendental argument seeks to discover what sort of foundations the house of human knowledge must have in order to be what it is. It does not seek to find whether the house has a foundation, but it presupposes that it has one. We hold that the anti-Christian method, whether deductive or inductive, may be compared to a man who would first insist that the statue of William Penn on the City Hall of Philadelphia can be intelligently conceived of without the foundation on which it stands, in order afterwards to investigate whether or not the statue really has a foundation. This was not a well-chosen illustration, because if you're not familiar with Philadelphia and its landmarks, you'll wonder what he's talking about. One of the distinctive things about Philadelphia, apart from its smelliness, pardon me, I lived there 3 years, didn't like it. The city hall has the statue of William Penn's on the pinnacle, okay? And so now Van Til is just using illustration. He goes, you can't first conceive of this. How does he say it? A man who would insist the statue can be intelligently conceived of without the foundation, in order that he might go out now and search to see if it does have a foundation. Not any statue, but the particular statue that sits that high up in the air. Now, you know that it has a foundation. Knowing that it has a foundation, then you can go search to see what it is. It turns out to be the building itself. But you can't conceive of that statue like that, you know, first as maybe not having one at all, and then you go searching for it. Likewise, when we argue with people, we're taking for granted that this life we live is intelligible, that there's meaning in this world, that explanation is possible, that you can give reasons for things. Bantul says, okay, now we can ask, what is that foundation? What allows us to give reasons, to make sense out of our experience? It should be particularly noted, therefore, that only a system of philosophy that takes the concept of an absolute God seriously can really be said to be employing a transcendental method. A truly transcendent God and a transcendental method go hand in hand. You can't use this argument for the limited God of Arminianism. Sorry. You know, Bantul's not trying to be of a party spirit here. But he's just pointing out that if you don't have a sovereign creator God, this argument's not going to work. The sort of God that we're talking about is crucial. He has to be an absolute God, not just one who is not one who is limited by external conditions. Why does Arminianism limit God? In what way? Help me. Okay, the free will of man as conceived of as independent of the counsel of God. Calvinists believe men have free will. They believe God is the one who predestines what they do with their free will. And they don't believe that man's free will is ethically able, so he doesn't have free will to make right decisions. But anyway, the Arminian says man has free will, but it's a free will that God can't do anything about. God just has to stand back and wait, either destroy the man or stand back and wait and see what he's going to do with his free will. So God is conditioned by man, is limited by man. Well, Arminians, in most cases, are our Christian brothers, and we're not trying to be mean-spirited, but we have to point out their theology, and it doesn't enable them to have the strongest type of apologetic. But there are people that are worse than Arminians in limiting God, right? There are religions and views even of the Christian religion that say that God is limited. Process theology says God is limited. God's working out his own history as the world evolves and so forth. So anyway, Bantul here makes it clear that you have to have a transcendent, absolute God in order to have an argument that's transcendental in character.
Dr. Bonson?
Yes, sir.
In my limited understanding of the transcendental argument, as it was presented philosophically by Kant, one of the things that I was thinking of, both in Kant's use of it and other philosophers not knowing to the extent that they're used, I was asking myself the question, how could they even conceive of the argument apart from the transcendent God? Is that, don't you have, you must presuppose a transcendent God, like Bantul says, to have a transcendent argument to begin with. Otherwise, you're defeated before you start.
If I understand what you're saying, Scott, you correct me, please, but Kant attempts a transcendental argument, but we'd say he failed. See, people mustn't think that what Kant did, Bantul now repeats and kind of spruces up. We would say Kant was trying to do the right thing, to find the preconditions of intelligibility, but he didn't find them.
Right.
Because he didn't have a transcendent God. He had to break up all these things, like the concept of substance, the concept of cause. These are separate arguments for Kant, and then he has to argue that's what the mind imposes. But Kant has no way of knowing, because he's not God, he has no way of knowing that every human mind works that way.
Right.
And why should every mind work the same way in a chance universe, which is what Kant thought it was? In a chaotic universe, isn't it amazing that all human minds think in substance terms, in causal terms, in mathematical terms and so forth? So, yeah, Kant doesn't really have a transcendental that does the job.
Nobody does.
Well, and that's what we're going to be arguing. In the end, the only worldview that can present a transcendental for the meaningfulness of reason is Christianity. And that's the best argument that we have.
Isn't there a transcendental proof by Aristotle?
Aristotle uses what's called a transcendental proof for the laws of logic, yes. And the difficulty is, as in Kant, let's say, I don't think it is as good, but for argument's sake, let's say Kant does have a good transcendental argument for the categories, for concepts like causation and substance and so forth. Let's say Aristotle has a good one for logic. The problem is you got to bring all this together. If the laws of logic are self-validating, so what? If you don't have a mind that thinks the laws of logic, big deal. And if you don't have a mind that can think the laws of logic in application to a world outside the mind, big deal. And so you see, a limited transcendental argument for this piece or that piece of intelligibility isn't going to help if you can't put the whole picture together. And I purposely choose that word, picture. I've been saying, what's our picture of ourselves? Also, more broadly, what's our world view? How are we going to look at reality, knowledge, and human behavior in order to make sense out of human rationality and argument?